Father, we come to you in the name of your Son, Jesus, and we ask that you would help us in this wonderful book that we're in. Oh, God, we so thank you for Daniel. We thank you that you trusted him with seeing where we are. And let us understand and go deep and just be who you choose us to be today. We ask that you would highlight the words and highlight our thoughts, that they would be pleasing to you. And we come to you in Jesus' name. Amen. Daniel 5, the destiny of Daniel. This is going to be a chapter that you're going to hear a lot of phrases that we speak in the vernacular now that came from this chapter. For instance, you might have heard before, you've been found wanting. That's from Daniel 5. You might have heard the handwriting's on the wall. You're talking Daniel 5. You're also going to find in this chapter the very first example that we could find in the Bible of cryptology, which means a form of deciphering that now wars all the way around in the history. Different generals, different armies, different skirmishes use cryptology to try to trick their enemies. We see a handwriting on the wall with cryptology on the first time ever in the Bible that we see that. Of course, Daniel, our hero, deciphers that code. You have probably heard the phrase, the idol has clay feet. We're going to find that. You saw that in chapter 2. We're going to see that more and more evolve as we go through the chapters of Daniel. Just a little bit of review of how Daniel's going to lay out. Chapter 1 was the deportation of those special teenagers. We know there were probably 70 to 80 of those. For sure, we know it was Daniel, Meshach, Abednego, and the other, there was probably at least 70, all from the king's line. We know that because we're going to hear in Isaiah from Hezekiah's curse that his lineage is going to be taken. We see that in Daniel 2 and Daniel 1. Daniel 2, we saw Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We saw the statue that gave the Gentile history for all times from Nebuchadnezzar clear to the Antichrist even. And in chapter 3, we saw the fiery furnace scene where Daniel was missing, but his friends were not, and they came out really well in that. Chapter 4, we saw Nebuchadnezzar's letter to the whole world, where the only time in the Bible a Gentile actually writes a letter, and it becomes part of a chapter in the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar's pretty important. I think he's going to show himself to be available during the reign of the millennium with us. I think he's in heaven right now. And this is called the handwriting on the wall chapter. You will know it from all the different inferences we've heard of that before. We see this same story like many of Daniel's stories. We're going to see it in Jeremiah. We're going to see it in different parts of Isaiah. Isaiah is going to refer to this. So if you are really, really interested, Isaiah 51 has a real interesting part of that story, talking about Babylon. Jeremiah is a contemporary of Isaiah, and so they're going to piggyback back and forth through lots of their teachings. So that gives you kind of a history of that. Babylon, for example, as we talk about it, is a city that during the time we're beginning here in Daniel was about 15 miles square. If you could picture a perfect cube, almost like that, because the walls were so high. So it is a very interesting picture of how it was built. We know Nebuchadnezzar was a wonderful general and a wonderful military genius. He was also an architect par excellence. This city, 15 miles square, had a wall at some points was 87 feet thick. In that day and age, it was impossible to have duplicated this. No one knows exactly how he got it to stand and how it was so secure. On Sunday afternoons, the historian Herodias says that it would be not unlike them to have chariot races, 6 to 8 chariots abreast, racing along the top wall of Babylon. He built the Hanging Gardens, one of the ancient 7 wonders of the world. It's known to this day not to be able to be duplicated, even though in Iraq, when Saddam Hussein was alive, he tried to build it. He could never figure out the irrigation system, and he hired famous engineers and offered rewards, and no one could figure it out. So that's another thing. The wall had 250 towers. 250 humongous towers. This city was impregnable according to modern man. The thick wall, most people believe that it was 350 feet high. so high that, like I said, you almost are thinking of a cube when you're looking at this walled, thick city. And it had the wonderful asset of having the Euphrates River that ran through it. Now, that brought it, made it pretty near siege-proof, in that when sieges happened in ancient days and armies parked around cities, they starved them out and they took their water away from them. So with having the Euphrates River cut right through the center of the town of Babylon, they were insured of free water and fresh water continually. That was a huge thing for Babylon. Actually, we're going to notice that the idiot who is the king of this time, Belshazzar, and I do say he is an idiot. He's ungodly and he is an idiot. He believed this city was impregnable because around him, there's an old story about Nero fiddling while Rome burned. This would be Belshazzar, because around him, Nebuchadnezzar's army had kind of all gone inside. They were all inside this humongously walled city. I mean, even his captains were supposed to be on the wall watching, were partying that night. His army was not out watching. They were inside partying. I don't know. That doesn't seem like a good strategy to me. When all around you have the Medes and Persians beginning to raise their ugly heads and taking out little captive villages all around Babylon, I would think that if you were really in touch with stuff, you'd have your mighty army stationed out, flanking all your sides of your big cities, but that's not what he did. So he's not a military genius. He's a very unspiritual man, and he's godless. So, yes, I think he's an idiot. That's kind of the setting for where we're at now. At this point in time, Medes and Persia have linked together, and they are run by a really brilliant general, and his name is Cyrus, and he has Darius under him, who's a commander, and they're taking off little towns all around them, and you're going to find them all around this walled city of Babylon as this chapter starts. Let's think about this for a minute. Now, you've got the Euphrates River. That's the huge asset for Babylon. It was known by Herodias that not only did they have the water supply, they had stored up enough food for 20 years inside the walled city of Babylon. No siege had ever lasted that long. So they believed they could outweigh any army that camped about them. So this is what Belshazzar was hanging on. But what he didn't understand is Cyrus understood the wonders of that Euphrates River. So he took part of his garrison of army and he sent them up north. And he began to move the channel of the Euphrates River, making a man-made lake. In other words, he dammed it up and he forced the flow of the Euphrates for a temporary time into a huge lake, stopping the river flowing down into the town of where Nebuchadnezzar's group was all banked in. In other words, in Babylon, they hadn't noticed that the river was getting lower and lower. It was a kind of a gradual thing. And Belshazzar was not a real bright person, and none of his army was told to be alert, so they all had their arms down. They were not thinking, and this river was getting lower and lower because up from the river, they were banking this river into a lake. It happened so that the southern army of Cyrus, Darius, was waiting to watch this river. Their command was, when the river is thigh high to you, the Euphrates River, you are to go under the gates, under the places where the river flowed through there. You march your army underneath. They can walk through. And you are to walk into Babylon through the Euphrates River under the gates. And sure enough, it took a while. Of course, Belshazzar wasn't watching for this. The river went down. And it is said in every history book that I looked at, every ancient history book says this, that Babylon was taken over overnight without a shot being fired, without an arrow, without a knife, without a sword. Because they walked in under the walls through the Euphrates River that had been lowered, and they took over the city without a fight. In fact, there are notes in Herodias about townspeople of Babylon that were walking around And after 3 days, they finally noticed there were some different-looking soldiers and went up and asked him, "Who are you?" And they said, "We're the Egyptians." People didn't even notice. There was no army that was killing them. And here's the nice thing you're going to find out about Cyrus. There's a lot of things I like about Cyrus. I actually believe we're going to find Cyrus gets saved in the end, too, because of Daniel. Cyrus's belief was if you took over a people, you listened to what their beliefs were, you tried to incorporate as much as you can, you tried to make them work for you. He wasn't the butcher barbarian that the young Nebuchadnezzar was. So when he sent his army in under the Euphrates River, under the gates, to take over Babylon, he told them, don't kill people, don't kill the locals, work with them. We're going to be in charge of them, but we're going to use them, and we're going to use what they know. So you're going to find at the end of this that Cyrus gets to meet Daniel, and he asks Daniel the whole story, and Daniel tells him, and Cyrus gives the decree within 2 years of taking over to send all the captives that had been taken when Daniel was taken 70 years ago. He gives a decree to send them all back home to Jerusalem. He said, you need to go home. This is who we're looking at. Differences in leaders. Now, I believe Nebuchadnezzar changed. You know that story. I truly do believe that. But I wanted to give you a background of what you're looking at. We're going to see a difference, too, in a real comparison. And I want you to watch this as we read. I want to remind you who Nebuchadnezzar was. Yes, he was brutal. Yes, he ran the barbarians of the armies when he was younger. And he took over and he became the king of Babylon. And yes, he took Daniel, and he took Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Yes, he did all that. But he got changed. You remember the story about him becoming an animal for 7 years and began to look up, and he changed. We're going to see a grandson from his lineage that is now king. We're going to go through several kings to get to him. And we're going to watch this idiot turn everything back to pagans. He's going to worship all the awful things that they've thrown away. And he is a barbarian. He is godless. And he has no respect for Daniel or Daniel's God. That's a real contrast. You're going to see him also where Nebuchadnezzar repented. You're going to see Belshazzar rebel. Difference, way different. You're going to see pride of Nebuchadnezzar broken, where he writes a letter to the whole world and said, I was so bad, but I now know God is God. We see his pride broken. Belshazzar is going to die with his pride intact. He's going to stand before the God Almighty of heaven with his pride. And God's not going to be pleased with that. So they're going to see some real contrast in that too. Let me tell you a little bit about the kingships, so then we'll start reading. Let's remind ourselves who Nebuchadnezzar was. His dad was Nabopolassar. And Nebuchadnezzar was his general, and he was fighting that battle of Tarshish when he got the word, your dad's died. Dropped everything, went home, he became the king. He then, after, we know his story, we finished it in chapter 4, that was the end of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4, where he repented, and God takes him home after a year, after repenting. Okay, that's Nebuchadnezzar. But he has some sons and some daughters, and that doesn't go well for them. Let me just give you a little bit of background. His first son that takes over is called a male Marduk. In English, it's evil Marduk. That's not a very good name, but that's who it was. He reigned for about 2 years after Nebuchadnezzar dies. Then there's some intrigue in the court happens, and probably assassinations. We're not sure. History's a little vague on this. Something happens after 2 years. And the son-in-law was married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. His name was Nergalassar. Now, he wasn't blood relative, but he was a son-in-law, and he becomes king for a while. And that doesn't go so well either. And then another son-in-law, Nabonidus, comes in. This is a court you would not want to have been in. Let's say, for instance, they're not sure who all killed who, but some of the daughters got involved. Evil Merodach reigned from 562 to 560. And they believe he was murdered by this brother-in-law, this Nergalassar, who came over. And then after Nergalassar, he was only in the court 4 years. Now, this is short times for kings at this time. He was also married to Nebuchadnezzar's other daughter. And then something happened to him that's kind of intrigued. They're not sure. But then what happened was he had a son who the Bible doesn't specify, but history books call him an imbecile child. We wouldn't say that today. But he lasted 9 months, and then he was murdered. And then another son-in-law, Nabonidus, comes in. He goes from 556 to 539. He has a pretty long reign, 17 years. And he then is replaced by his son. And that is interesting about Nabonidus. This is going to be the last bunch of Nebuchadnezzars who reign before the Medes and Persians come in. Let me tell you about them. Nabonidus, he's the one that reigned 17 years. He got in after that imbecile child was killed. We think probably he had something to do with it. Not sure, but history doesn't speak too well of that. Anyway, he doesn't really like being king. He finds out that he's more interested in being in Egypt and traveling the world, but he's king. He's king of Babylon. So when his son, the idiot that we're going to talk about today, becomes old enough, Nabonidus and Belshazzar reign as co-regents. It is interesting for the fact that Nabonidus is actually the real king, and he's off in foreign countries, and sometimes he's leading armies, sometimes he's just relaxing. History doesn't speak very well of him. They think he's pretty much an idiot too. But this son under him likes being king because he thinks there's nothing to do. He can just do all the riches, and he's got this fortified city. He didn't send out armies. He didn't protect himself. And though this is who's reigning, this is the central figure of chapter 5. You need to know who he is. And his name was Belshazzar. Please do not confuse that with Daniel's foreign name that Nebuchadnezzar gave him. Daniel was named Belteshazzar. There's a T in it. After Nebuchadnezzar's god Bel. This guy is Belshazzar. He's also named after that foreign idol, Bel. But he is co-regents now with his father, Nabonidus. When Cyrus conquers Babylon, this is who the king is. This is who gets murdered the night. I'm sorry, Cyrus comes in. This is who it is. It's Belshazzar. That gives you a little intrigue at court. Someone said when I was reading a commentary about this court, the intrigue and the murders and the posturing, trying to get these positions as king, that was a tough court to be in. So if you were after the throne, it's probably your neck. That gives you a setup for Daniel 5. I am in Daniel 5, 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. Right off, I'm going to tell you, if you know ancient history, kings did not do that. I will tell you why. You're not ever going to see Nebuchadnezzar doing this. You're not going to see other famous kings doing this. Two reasons. When they got drunk, they were very apt to be assassinated. I know that sounds weird, but if you look at history, what they said is kings never drank in front of large crowds because it lowered their, I'd say, thinking power or their resistance to be what's going around them. And also, they never drank in large crowds for the second reason is their wine or their drink was too easy to poison. We don't think like that today. I imagine there's a lot more of that that is watched in presidents and our leaders than we know. But poisoning and assassinations were what always picked the kings off. And so they never did this. This was not wise for him to do. So right off, if you know anything about ancient history, you know he's not very wise. So he sets himself up already in a bad way. You're not going to see that by many other kings or rulers. I'm in verse 2. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Really stupid. There are several sieges. I gave you a sheet that tells you the sieges of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't take Jerusalem in one siege. The first one is around 605 BC, when that's when Daniel and the 70 young king, prince, royals are taken. He takes the cream of the crop right off the bat. That's the first siege. He leaves a vassal king there, and that king doesn't prove well. So Nebuchadnezzar comes in again in about 597. He does the second siege. He still doesn't destroy Jerusalem there. And the third siege is when the temple and Jerusalem is destroyed. This is probably when most of the utensils were taken, although we know when Daniel was taken, some of the serving utensils were taken. So by the third siege, Nebuchadnezzar takes everything that is left in the temple of any value with him. This is the gold of Solomon, the silver, all of the precious jewels, everything that's worth anything. By the third siege, the temple has been destroyed, razed ground, in other words. So when you understand those sieges, this is the utensils that are specified here that Belshazzar is going to use. Now, he doesn't only just drink with them. He gives them out to his party guests. And he listens. This is another thing you don't see rulers do. If we want to go back to an idea of a feast, you go back to Esther and you watch the feast of Artaxerxes. The women weren't invited to that. He's got everybody here. This is how sure he is of himself that the more people that kings had around them, the more apt they were to be killed. That's what history books say. They pretty much, when they did a feast, they isolated themselves with a small group. Maybe the outer courts areas had big people, but access to the king was denied to most people when they had feasts. Usually the king and his generals, no women, and certainly not a big crowd, because you just didn't do that. It was just assassination. We already saw in this court, the death rate of these lineage was pretty high. I wouldn't think he'd be doing this. But anyway, that goes to show how he's not so smart. So he had his lords, his wives, his concubines. They might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the kings and his lords, his wives, and his concubines all drank from them. He showed no respect for any of this. Is temple merchandise. Some of this came from the Holy of Holies. We're not going to go back and do a study on that, but if you are interested in talking about some of that stuff, even the high priests had to be careful what they touched and when they touched it. Some of this brings a death sentence on, and I think we're going to see this enacted pretty soon. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Interesting. He drank it out of the gold and silver cups, and he's praising them as gods. We'll see. We'll see how that works out for him. I'm in verse 5. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. If you didn't understand that God was a real person, I think this would probably scare the average person into doing this. Let me talk about the finger of a God a little bit. This is not the first reference we're going to see in the Bible. If you hearken back to Exodus 8, it talks about the Egyptian magicians that tried to blame that plague of gnats, and they blamed it on the finger of God. That's from their words. And I guess they probably had that right. Exodus 31 talks about the finger of God is writing something. That's who wrote. The finger of God is who wrote the Ten Commandments, if you will recall that. If you also want to take just a peek at something New Testament, because I think the New Testament echoes the old, please turn to John 20:20. Let's see what Mr. John, another apocalyptic writer, wrote. And I am in John 20, verse 20. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. His hands is a kind of not right translation. It says when he held his palms up, they noticed his fingers. Another historian said, yes, they were looking for the nail scars, but probably most people believe the nail scars were up in the wrist. Most people believe that the actual damage from the cross nails were higher up where they could catch that cartilage. They were looking at his hand to see if his fingers had changed. They walked with him. This was the hand of God that touched blind eyes and made him see. That spoke his fingers over the water and he walked on it. These were the hands that they saw work miracles. And so when they were asking to see his hands, they weren't just asking to see that nail bridge, which probably would be up in the wrist. They were asking to see if his hands had changed. This was the hand of God that they saw. This is the hand of God that came on this wall. I think that's interesting when you think about what the disciples were asking for. I don't know if you've ever thought about that. When they asked to see his hands, they were more or less wanting to see this part. They knew. Most historians will tell you that the nails were nailed up in his wrist. So when you see a movie and the hole goes through the palm of his hand, not very likely. And a doctor could tell you that if you had the weight of anything on that part of your hand, it would rip out immediately. It had to put it here where it caught the wrist bone to hold the weight of the body. And I know that's graphic and gross, but I think the fingers of God is just a big deal here. So let's continue on. And that's there's lots of other references to the fingers of God. If you want to look at Job, he talks about the hands of God making the world. He compares that, and David talks about that. We see that God has a body, that he is not just in spirit. Ezekiel saw him high and lifted up, sitting in the temple. We see Isaiah saw him. Actually, John was imported up to heaven, and he saw God, and he saw a body. So when you think of him in spirit, yes, he is. Of course he is. Jesus was too, but of course he was a body. You are spirit, and you are a body too. This is a real body they're seeing. This is like one of those, oh my goodness. Kind of an interesting take on thinking of God like that. So I'm going to go back and just recap on 5. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. The king saw the part of the hand that wrote, didn't see the whole body of God. He saw his hand, he says. Verse 6. And the king's countenance changed. Note this. This is the braggart. This is the man who has no armies out watching for treachery. He doesn't even worry about getting assassinated or being poisoned. This is a guy that has the ultimate chutzah, I'd say, to think he's going to be immortal. But his countenance changes. This is real important. And his thoughts troubled him. Finally, something gets through to him. Finally, he gets it. Oh my goodness. This might not be good. So that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked. Have you ever heard the term, your knees knocked?
Uh-huh.
This is where it comes from. It comes from Daniel. Now, I want to tell you what the joints loosened mean, and you're going to have to excuse me being a little graphic here. This means he needed depends. He got so scared that something happened in his lower trousers that was not good. If he had worn brown trousers, it would have not showed as much. Am I making myself kind of clear here? That's what that means. I did a word search on that. You kind of lose that. One of the favorite commentators says the delicate King James English didn't say that he lost control of his bowels. He was so scared. But that's what it really means. His knees knocked. You hear that all the time. Your knees are knocking. It's from Daniel. Say, if anyone ever says it against you, I know where that comes from. That comes from Daniel 5. Let me put it in really simple English. He was really scared. He was afraid. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. Interesting use of terms here. Let's go back. He's scared. He's scared that he's soiled his pants, his knees are knocking, and he's going to call in the best minds that he knows. Who does he know? He doesn't know Daniel. In fact, we're going to find out later he's never met Daniel before. When Nebuchadnezzar died, Daniel would have been old. He would have been 85 maybe when Nebuchadnezzar died. Maybe 80. So he's been retired, and he's probably been working around the temple and working around with his captives and keeping them close to God. But this guy doesn't know Daniel. So what he does is he calls what he knows. He calls the soothsayers, the witches, the fortune tellers. Let's just call them what they are. The devil worshipers. The pagan idol worshipers. He calls them in for help. Now, how much help do you think they're going to be? Let's see. Remember, he doesn't know Daniel. Oh, he also says, if you tell me the truth, if you tell me the interpretation of this writing on my wall, I'll make you the third ruler. Now, how could that be? Well, his dad was the first ruler. Remember, I told you, his dad was overseas. He was doing campaigns all over. And Belshazzar was co-ruler with him. So those are two rulers. He can't promise him that he'll make it first or second ruler, because that's not the legend. But he says, I'll make you third ruler. This is a point of history. I want to point out that for years, people didn't believe Daniel was a real book and that it wasn't authentic. And historians used Daniel 5 to say Daniel is not an authentic book of the Bible, because there was no history anywhere in ancient books, in ancient annals. It nowhere where it mentioned Belshazzar. He was never mentioned. It went to Nabopolassar, and then it talked about Cyrus. So they this chapter, this one verse right here, made people who were trying to disprove Daniel said, well, that proves it. There, Daniel's not right. And then they found this little tiny stone when they were digging in Babylon, and it explained about Nabopolassar, and he didn't like being king, and that he had a co-regent, his son Belshazzar. And all the scoffers and all the naysayers about Daniel had to back up and go, wow, God's always right. The Bible's always right. But that third ruler is that proof too. So he's going to make him the third ruler if whoever can do this. Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Surprise, surprise. These guys are counterfeits. These are charlatans. They don't have any power. They're the devil. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. See, he thought, they'll tell me the truth and I'll figure it out. They couldn't do it. Now he's really worried. Really, really worried. His countenance was changed and his lords were astonished. They had, his lords, his captains, his high up guys had never seen him upset about anything because life had been good for him. He came in, peaceful times, had a lot of money, big walls, lots of generals, lots of food for 20 years, water Euphrates coming down, nobody can get me, I'm going to party, I got everything I want, and now the tide has turned and he is worried. Verse 10. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. We know that this could be two people. This is not his wife. This is more like a queen mother. This is either one, his dad's wife, who's traveling overseas, or it's more likely his grandmother. It's probably Nebuchadnezzar's wife. Because, and let me explain about those days, you're going to hear referred as father and mother. They didn't have the word grandmother, grandfather. If you were talking about a lineage, for instance, like if we were saying he's from the lineage of David, we talk about the Messiah being from the lineage of David. Well, we know that we could say David was his father. We know that that's not true, that his immediate father. It would be great, 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 great grandfather. And anybody in your lineage was called your father or mother. So don't be confused that they didn't say this is his grandmother. It probably is his grandmother. And she was probably Nebuchadnezzar's wife. All people that study this tend to lean because we're listening to her words. And here's what she says. O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, you know, so that goes back to grandfather, and probably she's saying in the days of your grandfather, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father of the king, made him chief of the magicians, of the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. So what she's saying is, I know somebody. I remember somebody who could tell things more than any of your soothsayers. And the only one that would have really known that was someone that would have probably been close to Nebuchadnezzar. So it's probably his wife. Verse 12, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. You're going to get it right here. Daniel's not part of the court. This king doesn't know him, and it takes a grandmother coming in that remembered back into the days of Nebuchadnezzar when Daniel meant a lot to Nebuchadnezzar. She would know that. Belshazzar's wife wouldn't know that. Belshazzar's mother wouldn't know that. But his grandmother would, and that's who this woman is. I'm in verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, I want to point out one other thing. Daniel probably lived pretty close. He probably even lived in one of the areas of the palace. His palace is huge. It's like a city. So wouldn't it be strange that Belshazzar didn't know him? They hadn't run across each other. You're going to find out through this writing, Daniel has no use for this man. He doesn't love him. He doesn't respect him. And he gives him no quarter. We saw, let's review a little bit. We saw with Daniel that he really loved Nebuchadnezzar. I believe he did. I believe they grew up kind of together. I mean, he was captured when he was a teenager, and Nebuchadnezzar was also a teenager. I believe Daniel made it his mission in his life to change Nebuchadnezzar's heart through God, and I believe he succeeded in that. And through that, he fell in love. I don't mean this in a sexual way. I think he loved Nebuchadnezzar because he wanted him to turn to God, and he did. I believe they're walking around the streets of gold now as buddies. I believe they were buddies. You're going to see a disdain and a contempt for Daniel now is in his late 80s, maybe 90. Wise as ever, loves God as much as ever, and he can't stand this young man. Watch his words. Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah?" He doesn't know him. He wouldn't know him if he saw him. "I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you," probably just now from his grandmother, "that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed in purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Think what he's offering Daniel. He's offering prestige and power and gold. Daniel's almost 90. Daniel serves the living God. Listen to Daniel. "Then Daniel answered and said to the king, 'Let your gifts be for yourself.'" I love that. "And give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation." This is Daniel thumbing his nose at this young king. And Daniel at this point has nothing to lose. You know what he's saying? "I don't care what you think about me. Take my head off. I don't want your gifts. But yeah, I'm going to tell you what it says because you need to know it." So here's what he says. "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory, and honor." Daniel's going to rant for a little bit about Nebuchadnezzar. He's going to tell this young, upstart, stupid imbecile, "You want to know what a king is? You want to know what it is to rule with power and find God? I'm going to tell you about your grandfather because you've forgotten." This is what Daniel says. "And because of him, the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down." He's reminding him, "You want to know a king? You should act like your grandfather. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened with pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him." Now this is going to reminding him what happened to his grandfather. "Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses." And he's going to take him right around to where Nebuchadnezzar changed and got saved. Maybe there's hope for this stupid young man if he tells him the story. "But you, his son Belshazzar," or his grandson, "have not humbled yourself, your heart, although you knew all this." No one should know this story of his grandfather better than Belshazzar. Everyone in the whole kingdom knew the story because Nebuchadnezzar posted it. He wrote a letter to the whole world. We read it in chapter 4. And Daniel's saying to this kid, "You should know this story. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your breath in his hand. and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. If you want to pick a phrase that brought home to me the sovereignty of God in this story, I reread that several times. The God who holds your breath in his hands. And he is this old, wise, wonderful Daniel telling this stupid, pompous king, you think you're so smart? You're worshiping this gold and this idol and this wood. And I know a God that holds your breath right here. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written. Daniel's telling him, you want to know who wrote this? Those fingers hold your breath right here. And they reached down from the veil of heaven, and they wrote you a warning. And when someone points their finger at me, sometimes they do, I always think of this story. God not only pointed his finger down, I'm sure when they took those utensils that were holy, and they used them in the most profane ways, I think God had had enough. He'd had enough a long time ago, but this was the capping point where he reached his hand down through the veil of heaven, and he pointed his finger at Belshazzar, and they began writing. Think about the time when Jesus was pressed by the Pharisees and Sadducees with the woman who was caught in adultery. And they brought her to him, and they basically threw her at his feet and said, she was caught in the act of adultery. What are you going to do about it? And handed him stones. Jesus' act is very telling. It's so like God here. Jesus reached out, got down to the ground, and he took his finger. The Bible says, with his fingers, he wrote in the ground. I would love to know what he was writing. Maybe the same message. But Jesus used his fingers, and they kept asking, what are you going to do about him? Or her, what are you going to do about this woman caught in adultery? And Jesus kept writing, the Bible says, with his fingers in the sand. And then he stood to them and said, any of you not have any sin? You cast the first stone. God is taking his fingers and reaching through the space contingent of time, and I don't know how that works. Rarely do we see the body of God come down, but this is part of his body, and he's pointing his finger. Like Jesus really was, the Pharisees and Sadducees, by writing, he was really pointing his fingers at those religious people and saying, yeah, you cast the first stone. God's pointing his finger at Belshazzar and he's saying this. And this is an inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Not only did Daniel read the words to him, he told him what it meant. Mene. God has numbered your kingdom. You ever heard your days being numbered? This is it. This is Daniel. And finished it. Take all. You have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Oh, that's such a common phrase. But if you've been found wanting. You've been weighed and found wanting. God has this balance system, and I don't know how it works, but it works real well. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. In fact, while this hand is writing, they've already come under his gates and they're walking around his city. He doesn't even know it. The people that are in that city aren't even afraid of him. They're talking to him. They don't even know who they are. They've already taken over the city. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple, put a chain of gold around his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. I asked God about that. That one part seemed to trouble me because Daniel said, before, I don't want this. But I realized what God was doing with this. Maybe you already got it. Here's what I think. I think he had to have that label as third ruler in the kingdom so that when Cyrus came in, he was brought right to Daniel. It's interesting. We're going to watch Cyrus meet Daniel, and he's going to love him right off. Had he not been brought in to interpret, had he not been given that royal treatment by this idiot and called third in command, because, you know, he's king. He can make third in command whoever he wants to. Now, his dad's far off. He's going to get killed, so Cyrus is going to meet Daniel. I realize now that's why Daniel was appointed this. He didn't care about the robe. He didn't care about the gold. But being third in command, I believe, was God set up for the next kingdom to meet Daniel. So watch what happens. I'm in verse 30. That very night, God didn't wait very long. Those fingers came down, pointed at him, and told him, you're done. Here's what happens. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. History says stabbed through with a sword by one of his own men. I don't know that. The Bible doesn't go into it. We know that Cyrus doesn't do much killing, so it's very likely one of his own generals realizes what stupid, idiot things he was doing and took care of it. We don't know. He was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. There's always questions between Darius and Cyrus. Don't be confused by that. Cyrus is the ruler. Darius is the general. And they do use those terms interchangeably. I don't know why. It's like our president's called commander-in-chief. It makes you think that he's an officer. Really, he isn't. Sometimes those terms, so you're going to hear Darius the Mede, and Cyrus the Persian. It is a dual kingdom. If we follow back to Daniel 2, when we saw the statue, the head of gold was Nebuchadnezzar. The next part we saw in the statue was the breastplate and arms that were silver. These are two kingdoms, both arms. The Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. These two kingdoms had come together to join in one. So that's part of the reason why I think we saw that statue made like that. Now, a couple things you need to know. The Cyrus we're talking about is probably Cyaxares II. He was the son and successor of Astyages from 569 to 536 BC. And although Cyrus was the leader of the assault, it was all done in the name of Darius, and they're interchanged. Therefore, that's why his name is mentioned there. But in Daniel 6, you're going to see Daniel was not ignorant of Cyrus is sharing this, and they're co-regents. And so it's pretty normal to get those two names interchanged, because it's the Medes and the Persians. They're co-countries, if you could say that. Bible says he's 62 years old. That's why we pretty well know what his name is in this year. We know what year this happened. We know that 150 years before this, in Isaiah, he tells them in Isaiah 44 that they're going to be taken over by Medes and Persians. So this is going to be interesting. We're going to study that a little later on, how Cyrus is going to come in, and he's going to be met by Daniel, who tells him, Isaiah told us about you. And let's see if we should read that. Let's go to Isaiah 44. Let's remind ourselves who Isaiah is. I know some of you are studying with me right now in Isaiah, and so this will be probably a redundant speaking to you. But Isaiah is the prophet. It's about 150 years before Daniel. He was warning the kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern. The northern kingdom had already been taken captive. He warned them and warned them and warned them through four kings that the southern kingdom was going to be taken, and they're going to be taken by Babylon. This is where Daniel was taken. We're going to see four seas after that captivity of 70 years where he's going to see Cyrus. So let's go to Isaiah 44. And I love the way the Bible just ties itself together so that it's woven so tightly you can't really separate these things. And you'll say Old and New Testament. Of course, you can't do that. I am in Isaiah 44. I'm going to start with verse 27. Who says to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up your rivers? He's talking about the Euphrates River being dried up by the Persians so that there was not really even a battle. He sees that. Isaiah saw that. I'm in verse 28. Who says of Cyrus? He names the guy. Who says of Cyrus? He is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple your foundation shall be laid. Let me tell you what Cyrus did. Cyrus takes over Babylon without any fight, drying up the Euphrates River, just like we see Isaiah saying. Why does God call Cyrus his shepherd to perform his pleasure? Because Cyrus talks to Daniel. Daniel shows him this verse. He rolls out, old Daniel comes up to Cyrus. He rolls out this long scroll. He said, I know who you are. You're Cyrus. God told Isaiah about you 150 years ago and called you his servant. Cyrus is so blown away by this prophecy about him that he says to Daniel, I'm going to let your people go. I'm going to send them back to Jerusalem. They're going to rebuild their city. And this is why God calls him 150 years before he's even anything, before he's born or anything. God calls him his servant and his helper. And so we're going to begin to see that we're going to like Cyrus. We're going to like a lot of things about him. And Daniel is going to become friends with him immediately, and he's going to get tricked by his soothsayers and those creepy witches to send Daniel to the lion's den. He's going to get tricked, because of it, he's going to find God, and I truly believe, like Nebuchadnezzar, we're going to see Cyrus in heaven because of Daniel. But this is what's setting up for Daniel 6. Anyway, so now he's met Cyrus, and I just want to read those last two things to you just so you understand the real purpose. That very night, Belshazzar, king of Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede, working for Cyrus, of course the king, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And that sets it up for the second part of history, which we're going to call the Medo-Persian era. There are lots and lots of things that we could go into this. The study and contrast between Nebuchadnezzar and his grandson are great, great, great. The study and contrast between Daniel and the soothsayers. There seem to be always at play in the book of Daniel. As long as Daniel is alive, we're going to see him against the wicked and evil ones, how they plot to destroy him. And we're going to see that a retired Daniel, old man, no one knows exactly how old he is because we didn't know how old he was when he was taken captive. Best guess is taken captive at 14 or 15, served the 70 years under captivity under Nebuchadnezzar, makes him 84, 85. We've got a couple of years here. They're a fall. Then we're going to see him serve a couple of years for Darius and Cyrus. He's going to be 88 to 90 when he's thrown in the lion's den. I know that blows most people away. We haven't heard that before. We're going to see that here. We're going to see that Darius, when we use that interchangeably with Cyrus, is a title. Let me give you an example of some titles that we are familiar with. For instance, in Rome, they called most leaders Caesar. There were several Caesars, but it would be common for them to call them Caesar, and they all be different men. This Darius is a title. It would be common in Egypt for you to call the leader Pharaoh. There were several Pharaohs. They were not all the same man. So don't be confused when you hear Darius. We're going to replay that with Cyrus because there's the leader of the time. We are going to understand in this order of Daniel that there is going to be mishap after mishap and misstep after misstep. And at the end, we're going to see God rule. And when you review this chapter, you're going to see more colloquialisms and modern terms, phrases that we use every day that now you can say, oh, Daniel 5. And I think we see the demise of a wicked ruler, unwise ruler, and we see what happens when they blaspheme God. What he did with the utensils at the big celebration was not only stupid, it was blasphemy. God will only go so far. It makes me a little afraid for America when we have rulers that take our God so lightly. It makes me cause to pray. And in summing up, you've got to contrast Nebuchadnezzar with his grandson. You've got to also talk about God's mercy for Nebuchadnezzar. If you watch the mercy of Daniel for Nebuchadnezzar, I don't see it anywhere for Belshazzar. Daniel walks into that hall, introduced to him, and he begins laying it out. He shows him no mercy. He doesn't ask him to repent. He just says, you want to know a king? You want to know how? You want to know this? And this is what's happening to you. And there is no mercy. And that's not Daniel. That's not what we saw Daniel do with Nebuchadnezzar. He has no use for this guy. That's how Daniel believes about the Antichrist. This kid, this stupid young ruler, is a portrait or picture of the Antichrist. Blasphemous, stupid, arrogant, and prideful, and his downfall is going to be the same. Daniel 5, one of my very favorite verses, is 13 to 14. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who was one of the captives from Judah, whom my father, the king, brought from Judah? I've heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. At least Belshazzar said that right. I don't know if he did it right. That's one of my favorite parts because it tells me who Daniel is. Isaiah 3:10 says this, "Say ye to the righteous that it shall be well for you, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings." Was this guy righteous? No. Didn't go well for him. And King David, Psalm 58, says, "Verily there is a reward for the righteous." Daniel's going to come out okay. Belshazzar, not so much. Psalm 5, "Thou, Lord, wilt bless the righteous. With favor wilt thou compass him as with a shield." And in this very final analysis of chapter 5, what you will probably agree with me is Belshazzar got exactly what he deserved. And the fact that Isaiah knew it, saw it, named it, and didn't miss it ought to lend real credence to how this Bible weaves back and forth. And so today we're celebrating that Daniel was able to be here, that he's going to get to go into the next kingdom. And I'm celebrating that God is righteous and that he does not put up with the garbage that surrounds. It is a very telling warning for all of us. And I believe we would heed ourselves well to reread Daniel 5 and remember that the Belshazzars surround us today. God, we come to you in the name of Jesus. We thank you for Daniel's truth and his word. We thank you that you appointed us to the righteousness of God and how our God has real hands. He has a real outstretched arm, and that he doesn't just point a finger in judgment at us, but he laid his hands willingly on that cross and he opened them wide for salvation. And God, I thank you for Jesus. I thank you that we see him in the hands of God, that we see him in the righteous judgment, and that we see him in the love of Daniel for his friend Nebuchadnezzar. Oh God, remind us to be holy, remind us to be righteous, and remind us most of all to keep you focused and front in our mind, in our thoughts, in our words, and our deeds. And we give you praise because of your risen Son. Amen.